This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 13th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from John Bailey, a journalist working in North Korea.
On the surface, it seems as though there's some transparency. It doesn't seem to be the case at all. There's still a lot of insecurity.
We'll hear what's got people talking in Cologne when we check in with Nelly Gottschewer.
What's really lovely is like everybody seems to know everyone, and people are really kind of, you know, like chatty and friendly on the streets. And yeah, everybody's been really lovely and polite.
It's Friday, so we'll talk edits with Monocle's Santiago Toditi. And today we'll be joined on the line by Basque chef Elena Arzak, who's just been awarded the Verve Clicquot Award for World's Best Female Chef. Plus, we'll speak to author Benjamin Bush, the man who went from the front line to the film set. And we'll meet some of our neighbours as well. Today we head to the perfumery Lillebo.
Coming to the shop, it's actually living a full experience where you can watch the perfume process and how we mix the last process of the perfume.
All that plus a bit of music as well, all to come in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. First, let's get the news now with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. North Korea has said its much-hyped long-range rocket launch failed on Friday in a rare and embarrassing public admission of failure by the state and a blow for its new young leader, who faces international outrage over the attempt. The isolated North, using the launch to celebrate the 100th birthday of the dead founding president Kim Il-sung and to mark the rise to power of his grandson Kim Jong-un, is now widely expected to press ahead with its third nuclear test to show its military strength. Four protesters have been shot dead in Syria, and an army officer has been killed on the second day of a nationwide ceasefire, which was meant to open a path to peaceful political dialogue after 13 months of violence. Syrians have taken to the streets across the country in small demonstrations after Muslim prayers today. Activists said security forces came out in strength in many cities to prevent protesters forming rallies against President Bashar al-Assad. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and the anti-Assad local coordination committees said two people were killed as marchers tried to converge on a central square in the city of Hama. The British Prime Minister David Cameron and Burma's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi have given powerful backing to the suspension of sanctions on Burma. Mr. Cameron is the first Western leader to visit Burma in decades. He and Ms. Suu Kyi said at a conference in Yangon that sanctions should be suspended but not lifted altogether. The Dutch Supreme Court has ruled that the United Nations cannot be prosecuted in the Netherlands for failing to prevent the genocide of Bosnian Muslims in Srebrenica in 1995. The final ruling was the last legal option in the Netherlands for a group of survivors of the July 1995 massacre, when as many as 8,000 boys and men were killed within the safe haven area, declared by the UN and policed by the Dutch UN soldiers. Axel Hagedorn, an attorney at the Van Diepen van der Kruff law firm representing families of the victims, mothers of Srebrenica, said an appeal will be filed at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg.
In the Netherlands, this case is traumatic. The consequences would be very strong for the Dutch. So therefore, it would be, you know, take a lot of courage to decide against the United Nations because the Dutch state and the Dutch soldiers were involved. You have to see that. It is a political decision. You have to see it. They can, you know, argue on legal terms, but it stays a political decision.
The fall of Srebrenica to Serbian forces was the worst single atrocity during the Bosnian War and the first genocide in Europe since the Holocaust. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator has arrived in Istanbul for his first talks with the world powers in more than a year. Tomorrow's meeting between Iran and the six major powers, the United States, France, Russia, China, Britain and Germany, is aimed at easing international concerns over Iran's nuclear activities. And the mayor of a city in the United States is being hailed a hero for risking his life to save a neighbor trapped in a house fire. Newark Mayor Cory Booker downplayed the heroism, saying he did what most neighbors would do.
I'm a neighbor that did what most neighbors would do, which is to jump into action to help a friend. And I consider all of us very lucky. There was a time when I got through the kitchen and was searching for her and looked back and saw the kitchen in flames. It was really a frightening experience for me. I didn't think we were going to get out of there. And so I feel just very grateful right now, very lucky to be here with you today.
And that's the news at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, James. Let's get the world weather now with Thomas Schaffanacker.
It's Friday the 13th in Europe and a stormy Mediterranean. Across much of Italy, rain and strong winds. In Corsica during Friday, even warnings of 100 kilometre an hour winds. And it looks like this region of Europe will remain very volatile on the weather front throughout the weekend and into next week. Rain in Portugal and parts of Spain too. It's turning very chilly here. So April's kind of going down the drain. Here in the UK and France, chilly April showers. On to the weekend city outlook. In London, 12 degrees with sun and showers. In Madrid, 13, also sun and showers. Rome, 16, very breezy, frequent rain showers here. And in Stockholm, it's around 6 degrees, cloudy with a bit of rain. Now over to North America, and Mother Nature is really stirring things up across the US as well for this weekend. The eastern seaboard will warm up dramatically, highs up to 26 degrees in New York City and Washington, D.C. In the deep south, tornadoes are possible, while in California, after a week of rain and cancelled flights at San Francisco Airport due to weather, well, it's turning sunny now. Here's the weekend city outlook. New York City and Washington, D.C., 26 degrees by Sunday, partly cloudy and windy. San Francisco, 16 and sunny. Vancouver, 14 degrees with some sunshine. And finally, some global airports the next few days. Hong Kong's Chiap Lap Kok, 27, rain showers, possibly with thunder, so a little bumpy on arrival. Singapore's Changi Airport, 31 here, the usual weather. And also Narita International in Tokyo, coming days will be dry with around 15 degrees. And if you're off to Sydney, it's a sunny 25 here. That's it, I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffanacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Tomash. 18:07 here in London, 5:06 a.m. if you're waking up in Auckland. Midori House is back in a second.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 in your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now we begin in North Korea, where Kim Jong-un's much-anticipated and gravely feared long-range missile launch became a global embarrassment, failing just minutes after liftoff. It threw the planned celebratory press conference into panic. The awaiting foreign journalists in Pyongyang were kept in the dark about the missile's failure for more than 4 hours, until the state news agency finally confirmed what the Japanese and the South Koreans had already reported. The missile failed to reach orbit and fell into the Yellow Sea. It poses the biggest setback for Kim Jong-un's reputation yet, at a time when the new leader's keen to show the world the country is stronger than ever and also more open than ever. As scientists investigate what actually went wrong and Pyongyang pushes ahead with centenary celebrations, the foreign press are still there and they're waiting for answers. John Bailey is a journalist from South Africa's ETV, and he described to me what he saw in Pyongyang on Friday morning.
I guess from yesterday already, we could sense that something was coming because all the foreign journalists are kept in one room, and we could see that they were setting up the room to where we would be able to view the launch. But then early this morning on Friday, we suddenly got wind, especially from the Japanese media, that the launch has failed. And the source of the news was the Ministry of Defense, the Japanese Ministry of Defense, and soon the South Korean Ministry of Defense also released a statement. But what was surprising was that actually 4.5 hours after the failed launch, the North Korean state media issued a statement saying that in fact the satellite did not reach orbit. So that's quite a huge surprise. Normally they do not say anything. So that's how we eventually got confirmation 4.5 hours later from the state media here in North Korea.
So up until that point, up until the morning, there had been no official line on this launch would actually be taking place. However, all the journalists there unofficially knew that's what they were there for.
Yeah, this was the big one that we were waiting for. We knew that it was going to take place somewhere between the 12th of April and the 15th. Throughout the time, our minders and the officials here refused to tell us when it was going to happen. I think most of the time, they also didn't know what was happening. So we just had to wait in anticipation and sense what was going on. But as you rightly say, there was no confirmation from the officials until we got actually information from outside sources, those from South Korea, Japan, and the United States.
In the interim period, John, were you asking the minders what on earth was going on, or was there at no point a feeling that you'd get any line officially from Pyongyang?
Well, we did constantly ask our minders, like, what's happening, when is this launch taking place? Most of them also do not know, because they are medium to lower level officials who are guiding us throughout our stay here. And even we were told today when we went to witness the unveiling of these massive statues for Kim Il-sung, the founding father of North Korea, and Kim Jong-il, the former leader, we weren't told anything until the last moment. We knew something big was happening, but this also was it had to do with the presence of the new leader, Kim Jong-un, who was present, and that was a massive event that took place in Pyongyang today.
Aside from the confirmation that this launch failed to go into orbit, have Pyongyang provided any other evidence of what happened today? Have you seen pictures of the missile?
Well, we went to the launch site only on Sunday when the rocket was still in place and we was showed the satellite. But there's been no pictures whatsoever coming out of Pyongyang. No images of the satellite being launched on state TV here. And as I say, we can only rely on the information that we got from foreign sources in Japan, South Korea, and the United States. But then again, they've issued a statement 4.5 hours later indicating that it has failed, that the scientists are looking into what went wrong. But in fact, what has happened was it was the same mistake as the previous one in 2009, because experts told us that it was probably because it took less than 2 minutes before it shattered into pieces. It was the first stage of the rocket that disintegrated where the liquid fuel was. So that was the problem.
Well, the missile failure aside, how has your visit been? What have you seen? Describe for us what it's been like and what you've seen on your trip.
Well, it was surprisingly more transparent than in the past. I've been to North Korea before, but this time round they've really opened. The fact that they allowed us to go to the launch site, and it was because of a decision taken by Kim Jong-un, the new leader. And also when they took us to this very secretive space shuttle control room that they have. So clearly more transparency. I think the North Koreans were pretty confident that this time round they will get it right. So the third attempt at trying to put a satellite into space, it failed again. But there's definitely, in terms of visiting the country again, you can see there are even more cars on the road. So something is happening. But yet they are persisting with saying that despite all the economic isolation that they are facing, the economic sanctions, they will continue. And now with this young leader that they have, what most people on the streets are telling us, that it's a good indication, it's a good omen for the future of this country.
Well, a lot is being said about where the regime is headed now under new leadership. And from what you're saying, there have been slight changes and perhaps an opening up to foreign journalists. However, would you say, John, if you scratched the surface, would you be met with the same ferocity as you would have done 12, 18 months ago if you were to try and go off of the journalist trail or demand to see something that you weren't supposed to? What sort of reaction would you get?
I must tell you that we can't do anything without the presence of our minders. In fact, one or two journalists have tried to do that. They were severely reprimanded by the officials, told not to go anywhere, even when we are being taken away and shown on these government-sponsored trips. As soon as you stray off the path, you are immediately called to order. So there's still a lot of anxiety in this country. So although on the surface it seems as though there's some transparency, It doesn't seem to be the case at all. There's still a lot of insecurity.
That must make it impossible for you as a journalist to make a true assessment of whether there is change there.
It makes it quite difficult to get a real picture of what's happening here, because there is still a lot of poverty in this country, and it's without question that people are asking about, like, why do we have this rocket launch here, this missile launch, when there's still so much poverty in this country. So you find it difficult to get a true assessment. Even we spoke to a waitress who told us that when Kim Jong-il died last year, everybody was instructed to go out on the streets and to wail. Whether you wanted to or not, you had no choice. And again, it's what we saw today at this massive parade. There's another one coming on Sunday where people are just told to get onto the streets, make sure that you attend these massive rallies.
Yeah, tell us more about the statue unveiling. It did sound like quite a grand occasion and a lot of excitement.
Yeah, it was massive. It was a strong military presence, and you know, North Korea has one of the biggest standing militaries in the world, and that's what's really all about, to show to the people. I mean, first and foremost, this unveiling was for the North Korean people. There were certainly a lot of foreign dignitaries and delegates and the foreign journalists as well, but it was to show the people that the leaders are still there. In fact, those ordinary people that we spoke with just after the event said that they don't believe that Kim Jong-il or Kim Il-sung, that they are dead. They have a presence in their hearts, in their minds, and the reason why they're doing these kind of things is to make sure that there's a continuation of this cult personality of the Kim family, and it must translate into the young Kim Jong-un as well.
John, for the remainder of your trip, I'm sure that the rest of the media outside of North Korea will be speculating and discussing North Korea's military intentions, its civilian space intentions. But I would assume that the Pyongyang government will be keen to brush this under the carpet very swiftly. Will you and your peers be trying to pose any questions on Pyongyang for the rest of your stay on this missile launch?
Yes, certainly. We want to get more answers to what went wrong, because one of the foreign experts who are here told me earlier that the North Koreans are aware as to what went wrong. So we obviously would like to, when there's an opportunity, ask those kind of questions to officials here, whether or not they will allow us and give that opportunity again to ask those questions. We are not quite sure. But in terms of what's going to happen after this, we'll have to wait and see this. I mean, North Korea has shown in the past that after a failed attempt, there's always the possibility that they will conduct more military kind of exercises, whether it's missile tests or even nuclear devices. It's uncertain, and that's the difficulty of operating in this isolated country where you really, it's difficult to get proper answers.
And that was John Bailey, a journalist for South Africa's ETV, reporting for us from Pyongyang. Now, coming up next on Midori House, we'll have some great music, and after that, we'll be talking coffee in Cologne. So do stay with us.
Next week on Monocle 24, we're hijacking the second hour of The Globalist, bubble wrapping it carefully and taking it to the 51st Milan Furniture Fair, Salone del Mobile. We'll be coming to you live each day from 8 to 9 a.m. Central European Time, Tuesday to Friday, from the studios at Il Sole 24 Ore. Join me, Hugo MacDonald, as I bring you the best guests, news, views and reports as events unfold each day. That's at 8 a.m. Central European Time, here on Monocle 24.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Yeah.
Welcome back. You're listening to Majori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now let's get some music. This is Quantic and Alice Russell with Look Around the Corner. And was producer Quantic and the beautiful vocalist Alice Russell with their collaboration Look Around the Corner. Now, Monocle's Nelly Gottschewers currently in Cologne compiling the property prospectus for the next edition of Monocle magazine. And earlier, Sophie Grove caught up with her to hear more about the Ehrenfeld district, which she's been exploring.
It is up and coming. It's a really, really nice place, actually. And today I'm really happy with the weather also, so I'm trying to make the most of it. It's actually in the... It has about 100,000 residents now. It's quite a big area. And it's in the west, a bit northwest Cologne. And it used to be a very poor, even dodgy part of the city. But now it's this jolly mixture of immigrants and local residents. There are a lot of young families moving here in the recent years, but also it is home to students, artists and young creatives.
So is it a kind of Kreuzberg equivalent or a kind of Dalston of London? Would you say that it's really kind of this artistic hub in Cologne?
It is. It is actually, it's really funny because what I've noticed is like for every up and coming neighborhood, you always get the creatives coming there first. Because, you know, like you have like old abandoned factories, which is like the best place to open a new gallery or a new creative studio. So, yeah, it's kind of a Dalston because also it is a part, it is a party part of the city also. So, yeah, you have a lot of clubs, but mostly creatives. A lot of young designers are moving here, too. By designers, I mean, I'm talking about fashion designers, but also interior designers, industrial designers. So it's pretty creative.
And so what is on your hit list today? Have you been to any interesting spots you can share with us?
It's amazing. Yeah, actually, now I'm at the Chamong Cafe, and this is the oldest coffee roastery in Cologne. It opened back in 1949, so I just had a chat with the owner, Mirko Chamong, who has a story or two about the neighborhood also. And yeah, I'm sipping the best latte I had for a while. And what's really funny, because obviously Cologne is famous for its beer, but also I think that the coffee culture is blossoming. Earlier, I stopped by Frank Cafe, one of the must-see and try hip cafes in Cologne. And I'm also, maybe later today, right before I go to the airport, I'm planning to also stop by the Constantin Art Gallery, which is not in Ehrenfeld. It's close, it's nearby, but it's one of the best galleries in the city right now.
And so what is the vibe there? I mean, are there little shops and new like, sort of ventures springing up all around in Ehrenfeld? And have you found any lovely things to bring back to the office and show us all?
I did. We stopped by another coffee place. We stopped by the Cafe Van Dijk, and I got one of their house blends, which is really nice because I had a coffee over there too. So I got a package for you guys.
Okay.
I will also definitely make sure that I'll bring some of the, maybe two or three bottles of the local Kolsch beer. And as for the whole spirit of the place, it's really nice because there are a lot of new shops and bars opening on every corner. But what I love about it is that you can also, you know, like you can still have a sandwich at, let's say, a Turkish eatery that it's been around here for ages. And what's really lovely is like everybody seems to know everyone and people are really kind of, you know, like chatty and friendly on the street. And yeah, everybody's been really lovely and polite.
And I mean, this is a completely a personal little project I've been working on, but they're building a huge mosque in Cologne. Have you seen it? Is it finished? They've been building it for absolutely years.
I I haven't seen it, but I think that it's actually finished now because somebody told me about it. And I know that at the beginning when they started building it, it was a huge problem because, you know, it's a mosque. But also there is like such a huge Turkish community here, and especially here in Hanfeld, because you have a huge immigrant community, but also a lot of local people. And it's really nice. So, yeah, I mean, I totally see it happening. So, yeah.
Well, interesting. Well, thank you very much for dropping in and telling us what's going on in Cologne. And also, I should say, there's been a coffee shortage in Monocle, the Monocle office this week. So any coffee you can bring back is very grateful.
I'll make sure I'll bring you enough supplies, guys. Rely on me, seriously.
And that was Nelly Gotcheva checking in with Monocle's Sophie Grove. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Essa är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 podcast, ja.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bropa Jalavert. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be speaking to the best female chef in the world. We'll also hear about author Benjamin Bush's fascinating life, and we'll be meeting our sweet-smelling neighbours. But before that, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
North Korea has said its much-hyped long-range rocket launch failed on Friday in a rare and embarrassing public admission of failure by the state and a blow for its new young leader, who faces international outrage over the attempt. The isolated North, using the launch to celebrate the 100th birthday of the dead founding president Kim Il-sung and to mark the rise to power of his grandson Kim Jong-un, is now widely expected to press ahead with its third nuclear test to show its military strength. Four protesters have been shot dead in Syria, and an army officer has been killed on the second day of a nationwide ceasefire, which was meant to open a path to peaceful political dialogue after 13 months of violence. Syrians have taken to the streets across the country in small demonstrations after today's Muslim prayers. The British Prime Minister David Cameron and Burma's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi have given powerful backing to the suspension of sanctions on Burma. Mr. Cameron is the first Western leader to visit Burma in decades. The Dutch Supreme Court has ruled that the United Nations cannot be prosecuted in the Netherlands for failing to prevent the genocide of Bosnian Muslims in Srebrenica in 1995. The final ruling was the last legal option in the Netherlands for a group of survivors of the July 1995 massacre, when as many as 8,000 boys and men were killed within the safe haven area declared by the UN and policed by the Dutch UN soldiers. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator has arrived in Istanbul for his first talks with world powers in more than a year. Tomorrow's meeting between Iran and the six major powers, the United States, France, Russia, China, Britain and Germany, is aimed at easing international concerns over Iran's nuclear activities. And those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, James. Yes, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's Friday, which means it's time to talk edits. So joining me in the studio is Santiago Taditi. How are you, sir?
Very good, and you?
Very well, yes. I've just looked up a picture of a Bellini, and we were just checking the recipe there. It's all become apparent later on. But firstly, all eyes at the moment on Elena Rarzak, who's just won the Veuve Clicquot Best Female Chef in the World Award. And I'm pleased to say she joins us on the line now. So firstly, Elena, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm very, very happy, really. And thank you for calling me.
It's a pleasure to speak to you. I'd imagine the phone's been very busy since you were announced as the winner. You haven't claimed the award yet. That's at the end of the month. But what's it been like since you heard you are the best female chef in the world?
Well, first of all, it was a surprise. I didn't expect it. Last year, I was already nominated. Mm. And for me, it was already like a prize. You understand? And I'm very, very happy for my family, for the team of Artak, and for the cooking, the gastronomy in general. And I'm very proud to belong to a group of chefs that we are doing the best.
Elena, Santiago here. Muchas felicitaciones. I'm wondering, how did you celebrate?
Well, I didn't really have time yet to celebrate, but I'm celebrating with all the people that is around me, the chefs, the friends that found me, the media, and I'm very thankful for everybody. And when I have time, I will, of course, celebrate.
People sometimes forget that there's a story behind becoming the best chef in the world. For example, you've worked in Monte Carlo and in Italy and in London, just to name a few of the cities you've done stints in. Has it been a rocky road or a smoother ride to success?
Well, first of all, I work with my family, in the family business, and you know, my father that already got an award last year because of his lifetime achievement is a person that has helped me very much and always support and believing in my work. No, as well, of course, like you mentioned, I have been in Switzerland hotel school and in a cooking and hotel school, and as well in many places in France, in England, in London. I was in La Gavroche 20 years ago, spending 6 months. And of course, from one side, I had a lot of advantages because to me were open a lot of doors to go into these marvelous restaurants. From other side, I decided when I was very young to work in the gastronomy, and I said, why not to work in what you really love, no? And, well, for me, like in all the professions, you have to work a lot, of course. Otherwise, you don't arrive to make your job well. And but, you know, for me, when you like and you love your work, it's not so complicated.
Elena, it appears you're from a dynasty of strong foodies, particularly looking at last year where you're nominated, your father's won the Lifetime Achievement Award. And it goes beyond that as well, doesn't it? You've got generation after generation, your mother, grandmother, your aunt, all in the business as well. And an outsider may assume that you stick to traditional recipes and you have a signature family flavour, but you're method of cookery is actually very experimental, and it's very modern and cutting edge and research based. How do you mix that family heritage, which you have, a successful dynasty that you're from, but then move it forward and create your own food?
Yes, as you explained, I belong to a family since 18. I'm the fourth generation since 1897, and I work in a tandem with my father, and before was my grandmother, that she already explained me a lot of things, and as well I am happy that this award from Bev Clicquot remembers as well Madame Clicquot that lived 200 years ago, and the history remembers a little bit to my grandmother, now that she was as well a very visionary and very hard worker and a woman that liked his job very much. No, and what I do is even if we make avant-garde cuisine, always not forgetting your roots and not forgetting what is very good, and to support, of course, the products and with the taste, the local taste, but open as well to the world. There was no contrast of styles when I started and I joined the team in Arstag in the year 1995. And so for me was not so difficult to jump into our system.
Elena, your family's restaurant, Arzak, was the first restaurant in the Basque Country to be awarded 3 Michelin stars, which is obviously already an honor. And I can maybe ask you, is it a pressure now that you've also received this award as being the best female chef? Will this change somehow the service or the food preparations at the restaurant?
It's true that we need always, if you want to keep a quality and if you want to maintain the happiness of your clients and people that come to the restaurant, of course you need always, in a good way, I mean, a little bit of pressure, no? So this helps you to keep the quality. And I'm very happy as well that we have, since the year 1895, 1989 that my father got the 3 stars of Michelin every year is for us very, very, we are very happy about. Of course, I will try, I will follow my parents' advice that Elena, try your best always to keep the best quality and try your best and don't forget that we are here for the guests, no? And of course, I will try my best and not to disappoint it. The cooking and the clients.
Well, Elena, you're an inspiration to chefs, not just in Spain, but around the world. And I hope you enjoy the show at the end of the month. I do hope it all goes well for you and you enjoy your much-earned success.
Well, thank you very much. And I really want to thank you, the jury of the 50 Best Awards and of Best Clicquot as well. And I'm looking forward to going to London that has always so good chefs. And that I met so many colleagues like Heston Blumenthal and many, many others, no? And thank you very much again for phoning me and let me explain my happiness.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, Elena. And when you are in London, you must pop into Midori House. We'd love to meet you here.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias. Adios.
Ciao, ciao.
Elena Arzak, the winner of the Verve Clicquot, world's best female chef. Now, Santiago, there is one other thing we're going to talk about today, which is the 100 foods that you must try before you die. And we were going through the list earlier, weren't we? And you've had far more of these foods than I have.
Yeah, I think I'm reaching 84
out
of the 100. But to be honest, this is a list that what I like about this list is that it is familiar to everybody. It doesn't have a food that is too strange or too weird or inaccessible. Mm. It's food that most people could find in a couple of restaurants or just the supermarkets. This list is a trending topic right now on Facebook. So that's how I found it this morning, actually.
Any that you particularly agree with from this list? Any favorites that they've pinpointed?
Definitely number 7, barbecue ribs.
See, I'm surprised that's on there.
That's always my weakness. But then again, barbecue ribs, I mean, most people have had or can have the chance of trying ribs.
Calamari is always nice.
Maybe ribs not as good as the ones I eat in Miami in Shorty's. This place that's been making barbecue ribs for years, and it's also like a family tradition of the Rodriguez to go there every year and eat these barbecue ribs. But I was doing a review of the first of the top 10. Oh, actually, they're in alphabetical order, so they're not the top 10, but from 1 to 10 in alphabetical order. And the only one I haven't tried, if it's literal, is the bird's nest soup. If it's the pasta version, I have. But if it's literal, I mean, not yet.
I think that would be a bit
and bitty. Number 10, maybe you can explain this. Number biscuits 10. And gravy.
No, I'm left cold by that. I really don't know whether they're sweet biscuits.
Yeah, do you have to dip the biscuits in a cup of gravy? No, anyway.
Dolce de leche, love Dolce de leche, and also honeycomb as well. I can't argue with that. And that's all we have time for now on the food side of things. Santiago, as always, a pleasure to have you here. Monocle's Santiago Taditi. Now let's have a song. This is Class Actress with Keep You. And that was Class Actress with Keep You.
I cannot think of another photographer that has come from such a colourful lifestyle as Lee Miller to be able to compare her to. She inhabited a world that is so different from the world that we inhabit today.
I think she was a remarkable person if you could take her on her own terms and if you felt an affinity of some kind, which I did.
when you think of pop art, you probably think of Warhol and Lichtenstein and so on, but actually, no, it started right here.
A Surrealist Eye at War, a special feature programme following the life and legacy of the Surrealist war photographer Lee Miller, will be on air this weekend. You can hear it at 1800 hours London time on Saturday and 3 a.m. on Sunday. And it will also be available to download at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now, from a young age, our next guest wanted to join the American Marine Corps. To the dismay of his artistic parents, a studio art degree at Vassar College did little to dampen his desire to serve, and so he fulfilled his dream and joined the Marines, and two tours in Iraq inspired him to develop photography exhibitions back in the US. And once again, he found himself back on the art scene. Well, he moved into acting and directing with a regular role on HBO's The Wire, and he released his second film, Bright, just last year. It makes for a varied life story, and few memoirs can claim to include tales from the war zone and a film set. But Benjamin Bush's Dust to Dust does exactly that. And he joins me on the line now from New York. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me, London Colin.
Pleasure to have you here, sir. Firstly, tell us, when did your passion for the Marines start? From a very young age, I understand.
Well, honestly, I wanted to be a knight. And in my first explorations to England, my father took a London study group from America, and we lived in Edgware, and then again a second time near Hampstead Heath, and I went to school there in England. And, of course, knighthood weighed very heavily on me in a place that actually had knights.
And so the Marines are the modern equivalent, I suppose?
As close as I could get, yes. The beefeater told me that because I wasn't British, I couldn't serve the realm for the Queen, and it crushed me. So I think I've spent a life chasing that hope that I could once again, in some way, join in a noble effort.
Some people are brought up in families that have a long history of serving in the military. Was your family one of them?
Well, we leave the generation. So many people from America participated in World War II, not like England, where essentially everyone had to. My grandparents both served. My father's father served in the Italian Alps, and my mother's father served in Guadalcanal against the Japanese. So they were war babies. They were born in 1941, and they had a very different war at their back as they went forward to what became, kind of a change in our disposition towards the military and towards foreign policy, which was Vietnam, which they protested.
So they were war babies, but how did they feel about their baby going to fight a war when you kept telling them, I want to join the Marines?
Well, your parents are charged with the duty of protecting the child. That's the problem that you have as a parent, and keeping your child away from harm's way is the job. And I was always edging closer and closer. That line between risk and safety was one I was on the wrong side of, and they were always just out of grasp. And I think that is what scared them most, is that they could not protect me, and they knew that their job was to do just that.
Equally, at the same time as this curiosity in defense, was there an interest in art from an early age?
Oh, yes. Yes. Actually, of all places, I also saw Star Wars in England. And at that time, it was 1979. And I was one of the last Americans to see Star Wars. It was delayed a year to be seen in England. And I knew instantly. I'd always been a drawer. And a sculptor of sorts, but I knew then that I truly wanted to make films as well. So these two instincts grew together. I think they're intertwined and in some ways interdependent. I think they informed one another, the artist being endlessly fascinated with the environment, which of course serves you in war, and the martial creature providing structure, order, and direction.
Do both interests, art and the military, sit in harmony with your character? I know in the book you talk about not revealing as much about yourself as you might otherwise, comparing yourself to the other Marines. Was that because of your interest in art and, comparing yourselves to them, you felt different in some way?
I was never uncomfortable as an artist, and I never felt that I was compromised in any way by being an artistic Marine. We tend to think that they're very disparate things, but I've considered them always to be exactly who I am, and I never felt that way. I thought that I was always an artist, and I was always also, a Marine. It's just a natural inclination from a very young age, and if I chase the echoes of my life, those urges are very, very prevalent throughout. They were set very early, and for everyone else who watched me grow up, they almost seem obvious, despite the fact that most people consider them to be an impossible union.
Yes, poles apart, but as you say in your book, discipline is at the heart of it, both sides, in every profession, and you've had success in both areas, and that discipline carries you forward now, I'd imagine. Where did that discipline first come from? Was it your training in the Marines, or was it in education when you studied art?
Once again, I think they're both intertwined. I trained under some very strict commanders who, of course, gave me fine example of efficiency and organization. That's something the military, of course, is well known for. But I also was stewarded by my college professors. One was a wonderful painter, Catherine Murphy, and another was a sculptor and photographer, Harry Roseman. And what I discovered, of course, was that artists are endlessly disciplined. We all kind of think that they live this unstructured life of ideas, and we kind of have this impression that there's a great deal of casual nature to art, when I couldn't disagree more. I saw them get up in the morning and fight their ideas all day with absolute intensity. And I realized that only true artists lived that hard. And that spoke very much to military service. So they're different. I think they're different in their intentions, but not in their intensity.
Benjamin, let's look at your more recent work now, your last two films, and also your acting work. Did the dramatic things that occurred in Iraq and the things you saw, firstly, you represented them in your photography, but now, you know, the roles you took in The Wire and then your direction with, you know, these films that are quite fast-paced, they're thrillers, one of them at least was a thriller. Do you carry that experience from Iraq with you now in your work as a director?
I think your entire life is feeding you. All along, all of your work will in some way be influenced. All your ideas and observations rub against your work. They inform them, they populate them, and in some ways are inextricable. I think I brought back from Iraq the character of Caliccio. I was cast to play one line in one show, but I carried a certain weight. I held myself in a certain way that they ended up making Caliccio an 18-episode recurring character who was an uncompromising and frustrated individual. And I just come back from a very frustrating tour in Iraq where I had to bury all those emotions because you can't be emotional that way when you're at the head of a light armor reconnaissance unit, and also when you're dealing with people who are getting their first impressions of the outside world in some ways from you. You have to watch and be guarded. And, I mean, the British do this fairly well. The Americans are not so well known for being cognizant of traditions, cultures, and being astute about foreign traditions.
Benjamin, I must leave it there. I'm so sorry. We could talk about your experiences for a lot longer and talk about the book as well, which has been highly acclaimed. We must leave it there, though. Benjamin Bush is the author of the memoir Dust to Dust. Thank you for that. Now, every week at Monocle, we venture out of Midori House and we drop in on one of our many local businesses which surround us here in Marylebone. And for this week's Meet the Neighbours, we went to Lelebo Perfumery,
We're lucky enough to be just around the corner from their own shop in Europe. And whatever your poison, rose, bergamot, amber or patchouli, they mix every bottle right in front of you. We spoke to the manager, Carmelia Smell.
Hello, my name is Camelia and I am Le Labo manager in London. We opened the shop 2 years ago in 2010 and we are very happy to be here in London. It is actually the first boutique in Europe, so it's a privilege for us to be here. Le Labo, it's an indie perfume company. So we are selling a niche perfume. We also have a bath oil and massage collection, a body lotion collection, and a home collection with room sprays and candles. And what we are, actually being at Le Labo, it's being in the backstage of a lab where the client can be the witness of the perfume making. So coming to the shop, it's actually living a full experience where you can watch the perfume process and how we mix the last process of the perfume, where you could feel and touch the raw materials of each perfume, and where you can learn about perfume. So it's a place to live and to experience. The most popular perfume is the Rose 31, and because it's a very creative and I would say surprising perfume, because usually when we think about the rose, it's actually a rose for lady, quite pinky, greenish, but we actually design a rose for men that of course can be also worn by women. And our rose is the most sensual, sexy and striking scent within our collection and the most popular one. Trends, I mean, we do not follow trends. We actually behave like artists. So Eddie and Fabrice, the founders of the company, when they launch a perfume, it's because they would like to express something different. They are not following any trends. What they actually express is something creative, authentic, that follow their heart. It's like a Picasso, you know, when he is painting something, he do it because he feels an emotion or something to say. So Le Labo actually follow this kind of way, being artist and express something when they want. We will have new creations coming next year. Well, if we have something new, then I mean, we will of course let our client know, but usually it's more about something that we create because we felt it at some point. Our clientele is very diverse. I mean, we do have men, women, young people, but most of all, I think all of them understand us and they are a kind of perfume connoisseur. They like niche perfume and they are looking for something different in the market. We also have people that come from artistic industry, music industry. So it's a very creative clientele. But of course, I mean, I don't want to put any limits because loving a perfume can be for anyone. So, I mean, we have a diverse clientele.
And that was Camellia Smell from Le Labo Perfume Shop. And that's all we have time for on this episode of Midori House. It was produced by Katie Bilbao, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Sam Impey.